I'm Jason Klom, and this is Comedy on Vinyl. The year is 2020. The album Dolemite Is My Name, music from the Netflix film, the artist Scott Bomar, and my guest this week, Scott Bomar. Thank you so much for joining me.
Glad to be here, Jason.
So I was interested in this movie coming out for two big reasons. People already know what those are. One is obviously there are no movies that have been made about a person who became famous about self-producing his own comedy records. That's huge. How could I not talk about it? The other reason is a friend of mine is in a couple scenes. So you're obviously going to be excited when your friend is in the only movie about comedy records ever, right? And one of the things that obviously stood out is how how good the music is and how it serves a movie that is weirdly a comedy and a drama at the same time. Not that that's totally unusual, but there's a lot to unpack. So I want to maybe explain to the audience a little bit of the process of scoring a movie like this.
Yeah, be glad to share any insight into that that I can.
What was your awareness of Dolemite as a character before this started?
I've tried to remember where I got them, but I had VHS copies of the Human Tornado was the first one I saw, and that film completely changed my life. I think it was probably senior year of high school, ended up with a VHS copy of it. And I was like, this is the greatest film I've ever seen in my life. And not too long after that, I worked for a record distributor called Selective Hits here in Memphis. And we distributed the label that had all the Rudy Ray Moore comedy albums. So I was familiar with him from the Human Tornado, and then all of a sudden I was working in a warehouse full of his records and started buying them all. You know, on Fridays I'd get my paycheck and I'd also get a stack of records and cassette tapes and CDs too, and normally end up blowing most of my paycheck on records there.
Of course.
It's a dangerous job to have, a liability there. But so I was really familiar with him, and with Rudy Ray Moore and Dolemite, and actually met Rudy Ray Moore once. It was very, very briefly. There was a really incredible music festival that used to be in New Orleans. Now it's kind of on hiatus, but it's called the Ponderosa Stomp. And there's this really cool guy named Ira Padnos who kind of books all these different acts. It's sort of, he's a big record collector, and the Ponderosa Stomp is sort of like Ira's record collection comes to life.
Wow. Okay.
And he tracks down all these folks, and he hired Rudy to MC one year, and that was amazing. And then Rudy was set up with his merch table at the venue, not unlike it is in Craig Brewer's film. Mm-hmm. And I went up and told him how big of a fan I was and bought some merch from him.
So good. That is just, that's a delight. Because he was a guy who I think before he passed a few years ago, a lot of people that I met had stories of just like that. Briefly meeting him or getting to see him perform a little bit. Which, by the way, I've talked about it before. Like, it is it is the strangest act I've ever heard. I don't know what it was like later on in his life, though. I don't know if it was the same act, if it was just Dolemite, or if he was working in other stuff. But I feel like he stuck with that one thing for a long time.
Yeah, I think he found something good that worked and he stuck with it.
Boy, oh boy. And this movie was a long time coming from what I understand. Like, Eddie Murphy was trying to get this made for a very long time, if I remember correctly. While Rudy was still alive, even.
Yeah, you know, things tend to, you know, work out the way they're supposed to when they're supposed to. And then,
right.
You know, Scott and Larry, that was one of the really, so many cool things happen and so many great opportunities happen working on this film. But one of the, you know, I've been a fan of Scott and Larry's for a long time. They made so many great films. So getting to, you know, meet those guys and hang out with them and collaborate with them was really a special part of, you know, being part of this project.
I mean, honestly, if I can't remember if we talked about this on the episode with my friend Alan, but there's an obvious connection between this and Ed Wood, which is it's about an artist who makes stuff that is underappreciated in its time, but I think in totally different ways, because this movie is so much about a guy who ends up, whether he wants to or not, being kind of self-aware that, okay, what the stuff I'm making isn't perfect, but I really like making it and I'm going to keep doing it. And so it feels like there's so much sincerity in it. I'm wondering how you then take that and treat funk and blaxploitation music as a genre so seriously, when a lot of movies would go overboard and, you know, it would just be wow, chicka, wow the whole time and they wouldn't really think about it. I want to know what your process was in making this sound as legit as possible.
Well, the same way that, you know, all the cast and crew who work so hard on this film are students, fans, and immerse themselves in whatever role or craft that they're part of, you know, it's the same with me with music and with composing. I'm a huge film fan. I'm a huge fan and student of film scores and that, 60s, 70s, you know, exploitation era, and just those scores in general. To me, you know, the 60s and 70s, in my opinion, are kind of like the golden age of film scores, because they were so experimental. You know, technology was changing so much in that period, and so you have a lot of, you know, the use of unorthodox instruments, you know, synthesizers and tape machine, you know, delays made with tape machines and all kinds of cool things and textures and, you know, really cool processes people would use, really creative things people would use to get new and original sounds that fit what was going on camera. And, Eddie Murphy's performance in this film, it's, you know, it's a dramatic performance, but it's comedic as well. And, a lot of what I do, I really feed off the acting, and I really try to get a feel for what the acting and the actors are wanting to say and convey and what the mood is. And you know, Craig Brewer and his editor, Billy Fox, they are so, so musical. And this is the third project I've done with them. And, you know, they make it easy. You know, we're just always on the same page about things. And a lot of times things just kind of are unsaid because we're just simpatico. We're on the same page with things. And that's, you know, I don't know that it's I just try to do what fits the film. And I hopefully I did that.
It's just, I think the thing that struck me again in listening to the actual record itself was just again the amount of it's listenable, because it, while familiar, does not at all feel like, it doesn't feel like a parody. And again, I think a lot of people would definitely reach into their pocket for just a ton of musical stereotypes. Are there specific, I mean, is it specifically inspired by, are there any themes from like the original Dolomite films that make their way in that I wouldn't notice because again, I'm musically ignorant?
I think, I really did a lot of research, personal research on the music, and listened a lot to the original scores for the Rudy Ray Moore films. Mm-hmm. And I think more than anything, what I got from that was like the instrumentation of it. It had a lot of clavinet, which is a keyboard instrument. It has strings inside of it, so it's almost like a guitar, but you play it with like a keyboard. Mm-hmm. Think Stevie Wonder's Superstitious. That's like kind of a classic clavinet song. So I used quite a bit of clavinet as a kind of a nod to the, you know, Human Tornado and Dolomite scores. Another big influence with this film for me musically were the soundtracks of Isaac Hayes. I mean, Isaac Hayes is a figure who looms very large for me for many reasons. You know, he's from Memphis, Tennessee, where I'm from, And a lot of the musicians that I've worked with over the years are musicians that came up playing with him. And on our score, we actually worked with three of the players who were in his rhythm section. Willie Hall on drums, Lester Snell on keyboards, and Michael Tolles on guitar.
Wow.
And all three of those guys played on all of Isaac's film scores. Tough Guys, Truck Turner, Shaft. And I mean, those films and Isaac Hayes' scores, huge influence. Quincy Jones, another massive influence for me, for the music for Dolomite Is My Name. And Lalo Schifrin is another, was another big influence, and something, you know, his scores I was listening to a lot for inspiration on Dolomite Is My Name.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Is there, and pardon my ignorance again, but when you're scoring a film like this, are you scoring Final Cut only, or at what point is it you know which scenes are going to need your score? Do you score everything and then they keep what they want? I literally am realizing I have no idea how this works, even though I'm a filmmaker, but I've never had to deal with an actual score.
Well, it's done different ways. I think typically a composer isn't brought in until close to the end, when it's just about lock picture. And that's the way that the process was on this. They had nearly lock picture when I came on, and then I had maybe a month to write and record the music. Maybe not even a month. Maybe it was like 3 weeks or 3.5 weeks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the schedule is constantly changing. So sometimes you think you have a month to do it, and then all of a sudden you have 2.5 weeks. And then sometimes you think you have 2.5 weeks, and then all of a sudden you've got 2 months. I mean, the schedule it's constantly fluid, but you have to get in the zone and kind of at work, you know, really get in the world of the film and live in that film nonstop until you're finished. But typically lock picture, but, you know, on the other films that I've worked with Craig Brewer on, Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan, I was working on those at the, you know, script level. Okay. Hustle and Flow, I was going and, to the set and watching the performances. And, you know, again, Craig is super musical, and he already knew what he wanted. He already heard it in his head. And he was like telling me, as he was filming scenes, he was telling me what he heard. And then I would like watch it being filmed at the set and go home and write. And then they were also sending me dailies, and I would write to the dailies, and they sometimes would edit to my score demos. That's very unusual. That process rarely happens, but, typically your composer is working with a lock picture, because you don't want to, you know, have your composer do a lot of work and then it's like everything changes, because you're working, you know, with so delicately with all the cuts. But one thing that was really great about when we recorded the score for Dolomite Is My Name is that Billy Fox, the editor, came and he set up his like a mobile editing rig. And there were a couple of spots where the music and picture were just off by like a frame or two, you know. It was just barely not 100% synced. And Billy actually kind of was able to nudge picture just a frame, even a half a frame, just to really lock it in with the music. And I think that's probably fairly unusual as well. Usually they'll hack the music up to get it to fit, but Billy was kind enough to come to the scoring sessions, and he and I were working together, and that was really cool.
That's an insane level of detail and skill. That is remarkable. Holy wow. I am looking at the delicious looking vinyl, which, by the way, I gotta say, was designed to look just like an of era record, and it is gorgeous. This is the one with your name on it. I absolutely love this. I listened to it a couple times over. Is there anything, I don't ever get to ask anybody this, is there anything in the entire soundtrack that you're like particularly proud of, that you feel like just really is the essence of the entire record?
I'm Gonna Kill Dolomite is one of my favorite things that I've ever made. I really, really love that. That's the music that plays underneath the big fight scene towards the end of the film, where you know, Rudy reaches down and rips the character Wesley Snipes plays, like rips his intestines out. It's that's that one. And then the cue that's called Put Your Weight on It, which is the music under the sex scene. Those are my two favorite ones. And they're both the type cues that as a film composer, you kind of like dream of getting to make, you know, I'm going to kill Dolomite. I mean, it's this massive, you know, fight scene with like Kung Fu girls and Eddie Murphy and Wesley Snipes. And it's just, it's a dream. It was a dream to get to compose a cue for that scene. It was just so much fun because it was like action and comedy. It was really fun. And then, you know, who doesn't want to score a sex scene, especially when it's a comedic sex scene? So that was Put Your Weight on It was a really fun one to do. And musically, you know, that one is a little, you know, I kind of, that one has like some like 60s kind of British library music influence in it. They were, you know, I got to kind of touch on some different musical influences on that one besides just the kind of classic blaxploitation sound. That one was a little different, kind of European. I like it.
You're effectively getting to rescore a film that you absolutely love in a totally sideways way where you don't ruin it or eliminate the original score. But you get to take your own approach to what does this entire friggin' film feel like? Or what does this whole scene feel like to you? And that's got to be, like, I would imagine there's pressure, but it's got to be weirdly freeing to know that, like, oh no, this is kind of almost my opportunity to rescore Dolomite.
I never quite thought about it that way, but I did the entire time I was working on it. I did feel like whatever music I did had to be in the same world as what the music in those original films was. And the music in those original films, it's really good. The score and the music in those Rudy Ray Moore films, I really like it. And it's a little raw, you know. You can tell that it wasn't, you know, it's like the film. It's not a, you know, it's a small budget production, but it really works. And it really works with what's on camera. And that was, I wouldn't say a challenge at all, but it was something that I had to be conscious of in making the music, is that, you know, when you're composing a score, you're not only composing a score, but you're also producing a score. You know, you can write the music, but you also are responsible for the sound of it. And I wanted to make sure that the sound of the music was, you know, the sound was of a quality and a fidelity that people in 2020 watching a film would expect. But also I wanted to have a little the grit and the grain that, you know, the original music had and a score from that era would have. So that's I feel pretty good about that. I think we accomplished doing that. I think the film in general, I think, has that kind of vibe where it's contemporary and it works on a contemporary level, but aesthetically it has, you know, the feel of the aesthetic of the original Rudy Ray Moore films.
Yeah, without putting grindhouse filters over everything, it still feels like a movie of an era perfectly. On every level. Obviously, next time I watch it, I'm going to have to now rewatch specifically with an ear to the score, which I never do. And I have a lot of comedy friends and a lot of film friends who are big score nerds. Like, they love to listen to that stuff. I just always feel like I'm gonna have nothing to say or think about it other than, oh, this sounds great. Although this time around I was like, oh shit, there's just so much going on again that I don't entirely understand, but that I can appreciate on the level, which is again mostly that obviously for comedy to work, you know, long story short, you have to take it seriously. You can't act goofy. And the fact that you did that with music is that, you know, everything is so taken perfectly seriously. There are what is your involvement, if any? You're going to have to walk me through this. I apologize. So for the two Craig Robinson songs that are on here, are they, did they both exist beforehand? I'm now realizing I don't know.
They did. So all the music that's on camera, that's that the actors are performing on camera, those were produced and recorded before I became involved with the project and did the score. So I only did the score. The Bobby Rush song, I did work on that a little bit after the fact. But the other ones, the Craig Robinson songs and the Eddie Murphy songs with Divine Joy, those already were in the film and recorded before I got on board.
Right, right. I figured as much. let's see. I'm going to be all over the place, so I apologize already. Let's see here. Where did my notes? Okay. Yeah, there we go. So in terms of, you know, and I don't know if you work this way or not, but I'm so sorry. I just lost track of my notes. I was trying to write down, hey, I fumbled there. Why don't you cut that out so that I don't sound like a total idiot? But okay, so in terms of character theme, is there a ton of like character theme? Like this guy, somebody comes on and we've loosely got an idea for how they sound in the score, or is it more the feel of it and you're not, I don't know if it's character based or what?
Rudy has a theme, you know. Okay. Rudy Ray Moore in the film, he does have a theme, but that's really the only real, you know, the only character who has their own theme in the film is Rudy. You know, I sometimes associate different characters in a film with instruments. I'll sort of in my mind assign characters their own instruments, and I'm trying to think in this film how much I did that. I may not have done that as much on this one as I have others, but that's how I approach it sometimes. But Rudy's got a theme, but he's the only person in the film that has their own theme, but he deserved one.
Of course. Absolutely. Is there at any point, there's the regular pressures that come with working on a film at all, but then there's, I would feel like the added pressure of, kind of trying to do honor to somebody's legacy. It's weird working on a biopic. I can't imagine what that would feel like. Is there that kind of pressure? Like I'm helping tell this guy's story.
I didn't think about that much. Mm-hmm. I felt a very, very special connection to this project for many reasons. You know, it being Craig Brewer, I felt very connected to it because we've worked together in the past so much and successfully, and he always brings out the best in me, and I've, you know, had a real special connection to it because of that. Also, the editor Billy Fox being part of it, you know, this was the third film I've done with him, and I, you know, really enjoy working with Billy. Being familiar with Rudy Ray Moore and kind of, even though I only met him briefly, I still felt like I had a special connection to it because of that. And I felt pretty good about that. And strangely enough, someone else who's portrayed in the film that I'm actually met in real life was Joe Bihari.
Really?
Yes. Probably 15 or so years ago, a friend of mine was working for a record label and they signed Ike Turner. And Ike came to Memphis to work on his record over at Willie Mitchell's Royal Studio. And at the time I was doing a lot of work over there, and I'm friends with Willie Mitchell and his whole family. He's now unfortunately deceased, but when Ike was over there working on his record, Joe Bihari came, because Ike and Joe go back to the 50s. Mm-hmm. And the label kind of hired Joe to sort of, I think, keep an eye on Ike, make sure he got his record finished. And so Joe was in town, and a couple times I got to go out to dinner with him and Ike Turner. And so I kind of felt also a special connection to this film because I'd met and hung out with Joe Bihari some. So I kind of felt like, hey, since I've worked with Craig so much in the past, and we did Hustle and Flow together, and to me, this film has some similarities. There's a thread to me between this film and Hustle and Flow, with, you know, a character who's struggling to make their art by any means necessary. To me, that's kind of a theme in both films. And I didn't feel on that part of it, I didn't feel pressure. Now, doing a film score and just trying to make, you know, so many different people happy with the music, because everyone hears music differently and everyone has, you know, their own, probably everyone sees a film and in their head they hear it a little differently.
Sure.
So that part of it can be stressful when you're trying to, you know, get a bunch of different notes from a lot of different people and come up with something that makes everyone happy and that you also feel good about. That's probably one of the biggest challenges with film composing, actually, is that, to me.
I'm frankly glad that my question didn't affect you while you were doing it, because, I mean, who wants to be distracted by the idea that they're dealing with somebody's legacy? I mean, nobody's going to hire a composer who's just thinking about that shit the whole time. You've got to be doing your job. I just feel like this movie in the hands of the wrong people could have been just an utter piece of shit. And it's just one of those things where, like, if you don't appreciate it, you don't have that love for it that you have, you know, it's fantastic that they picked the right people up and down for you know, that the movie was made by all the right people who I think appreciate, holy crap, these movies are insane looking. They have this, you know, and when you're young, I'm sure there's usually this ironic appreciation of them. But I think maybe as you get older, it's like, oh, but that was still a human being trying their damnedest and trying their hardest. And making a movie about that is a fine line to walk.
Yeah, those films are so fun, though. I mean, I went back and watched them a couple of times, you know, when I was working on this project, and they hold up to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still get the same. I mean, the first time I saw The Human Tornado, like I mentioned earlier, it made a profound effect on me, because at the time I had not seen anything anywhere remotely close to that. I don't think there's anything else like that film, but I'd just never seen anything like it, and it really made a big impression on me, because it was just so over the top, you know, everything about it. And I particularly love the scene where he's in bed with the sheriff's wife and he comes in and he jumps down with no clothes on, he like only has his hat on, and he jumps over the hill. And they stop it, and he's like, I got to see that shit again. And he rewinds it, and you see it happen in reverse, and they show it again. I thought that was the funniest, most brilliant thing that I'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm. I love that so much. That's so good. Well, you know, so just weirdly, again, to bring it back briefly to my friend who's in it, he's only in it for two scenes. He plays one of the film company executives. He's smoking in the background for much of it, but has a couple lines. He had the same exact experience, and I could be wrong, but I feel like he said he also loves The Human Tornado a ton. But yeah, he had the same experience in college. He had happened to pick them up, and it has definitely influenced his own filmmaking, and I can see it left and right. Like, he's made a few blaxploitation having fun with the idea of blaxploitation movies with some friends. And I like seeing what that does to people's personal aesthetic and like what they and the way they explore their own art through somebody else's genre. It is interesting. What's your experience with comedy records? Just to go to the theme of this show normally, like do you listen to a lot of comedy? Did you as a young guy?
I do. I'm a huge fan of comedy records. Probably comedy cassettes is where I have more experience, just from being a touring musician for over half my life. You know, mm-hmm. you're driving and, you know, across the US and you pull into a truck stop and not so much anymore, but back in the 90s and early 2000s when I was doing touring, you would stop at a truck stop and they'd have these huge cardboard bins full of comedy cassettes and CDs. And so that, there's not anything better to listen to on the road than comedy. Mm-hmm. And I love Don Rickles. He didn't do that many comedy albums, but I know he's got two. Mm-hmm. Hello Dummy is one of them. It's funny, when I was, when we were, emailing and you were telling me about your show, it made me think about, I started thinking about comedy albums, and it made me think of one of my most prized possessions, which is a signed copy of Don Rickles' Hello Dummy, his Warner album. And probably, I guess my wife and I both, we share many things in common, but one of them is our love for Rickles.
Love it.
And it seemed like every time we would be somewhere out of town, he would have just played, or he was just going to play like right after we left. So we were like, man, we're never going to get to see him. And to us, the idea of actually seeing Don Rickles live was like, it was like, we couldn't imagine anything that we wanted to do more in life. And mm-hmm. So this was maybe, it was about a year before he passed away. At that time, like the last couple of years of his life, he was only doing like maybe, as far as I know, he was only doing about 4 shows a year.
Okay.
And he'd really cut back on the shows. And Carrie, my wife, she saw where Rickles was performing in Florida. And her parents live in Florida. And so for my birthday, she bought a pair of tickets.
Yes.
And we flew to Florida and we saw Don Rickles and went and visited my in-laws. But we saw Rickles. I took the album and I took a Sharpie. And I'm like, God, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I got to get him to sign this record. And we hung out like after the show, and we were kind of like sneaking around the theater. And we started talking to some people. This really nice lady that worked at the theater, I explained to her how much it would mean to us to get Rickles to sign the album, and she took it back and he signed it for us.
Love it. That's good.
That's my, of course, that's my favorite comedy album because of that story. But Rodney Dangerfield, big fan. Mm-hmm. I have his comedy albums, Red Fox. I've got quite a few Red Fox comedy albums. That's one of the other cool things about Dolomite Is My Name. When they're in the record store, they're listening to a Red Fox album. And I thought that was cool. I've got albums on that Laugh label.
Mm-hmm.
Familiar with the Laugh, LAFF label?
Yeah, big time.
A lot of those I buy just for the covers.
Of course. Yeah, they're fantastic.
Let's see. There's another I've got an album by a guy named Dap Sugar Willie.
Wait a minute. I've seen those covers. I feel like I've seen one of those covers.
Yeah, I'm gonna
look this up.
It's definitely in the same family a little bit as Rudy Ray Moore.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good record. I don't know how many albums he did, but he's got one that's you see fairly often, and that's a pretty entertaining record. It's kind of got it's almost like that rapping style. It's almost similar to what Rudy Ray Moore did.
Mm-hmm.
I've got Jimmy Walker's Dynamite album. Pretty good collection of Cheech and Chong LPs.
Sure.
The Up in Smoke soundtrack, I don't know if that counts as a comedy album, but the Up in Smoke soundtrack was like, when I was younger, was one of my favorite records. I loved Up in Smoke and I loved that soundtrack. I'm crazy about Up in Smoke.
Love it. Yeah, honestly, that's one of those things too, where on this show I vacillate, but I have definitely been like, okay, do you want to come on the show and talk about your favorite movie? If the soundtrack was released on vinyl, we can do it. Because, here's the thing. You are the very argument for why it's worth talking about, because it's not like, you didn't think about the comedy of it while you're making the music. So it is comedy. You're enhancing comedy with this music, which is again why I love it.
Comedy, you were talking about comedy earlier,
mm-hmm.
how you have to take it serious. And the other thing, similarity between comedy and music is the timing.
Sure.
It's all about the timing.
Mel Brooks was a drummer as a young man. Like that's the ultimate example, I think, of how musicians have, you know, there's always the thing people like to say is like comedians want to be musicians and musicians want to be comedians. Have you ever been tempted to be a comedian?
I don't know if I could get on stage and perform it, but I've definitely considered writing it sometimes. Mm-hmm. I sort of have some running jokes in my head and I'm like, man, I don't know. It's might be pretty good material. I think it's funny. Maybe I could do something with this.
see, it's, there's something about it. I wish nobody has figured out what that algorithm is and why it is, but there's so much crossover. Let me see. I know I have a million questions for you. This is just such a great coming together of people. Like, I don't know. It's just the perfect combination. And even though we had to wait this long for the movie to happen, I'm glad it did. There's no other, can you think of another movie where comedy albums is a part of the plot? That's one of the reasons I love this so much. I can't think of another.
When you said that earlier, I started thinking like, there's gotta be something.
There has to be. But I can't think of one where it's this prominent, where they literally had to recreate some of the album covers, but with Eddie Murphy on them, which by the way, I'm going to do my damnedest to get a hold of one of those. I don't know what it's going to take, but I want one of those Eddie Murphy as Rudy Ray Moore records. Cause I know a few of them look like they're the originals, but there's definitely a couple that are obviously up close where it's his face on there. That's the kind of stuff that I get super excited about because they've got to exist somewhere. If I were an extra on that film, which why would I be? But if I were an extra on that film, I would have taken one home. You're not supposed to do that, but I absolutely would have done it. I love that you've got a good collection of comedy records. I'm getting a feel for the kind of comedy that you like to listen to. If you were to come back on this show, would you pick Hello Dummy to talk about? Or is there another record that is maybe like burned in your brain? Would it be a Cheech and Chong album? Do you like
music? It's so hard to say. I think I'd have to really, I need to go on a expedition through my collection.
It's fair.
It may not even be an entire album. It could be like a 45 because I have some good comedy 45s. Like, I don't know. I guess to me, comedy and novelty, where do those two separate? Because I have a lot of comedy 45s and a lot of novelty 45s. So before I came on your show, I should have gone through my collection and done a little bit more research, but
I didn't prepare you for that question at all. Don't worry about that. Yeah. Come on, that's on me. Well, you know, it's funny. I was digging through cause I was finally logging my 500 or 600 records, comedy records, and I was finally writing them down. So I know what I have. And so the people who want to get me gifts, thank you very much, friends, will know what I have. Cause I get repeats all the time. But one of the early Red Fox records that I have his first couple. They literally do say novelty on the back and it's just like, that's weird to me. It is strictly comedy. The man ended up breaking ground, being one of the first stand-ups like to sell as many records as he did. He made more stand-up records than just about anybody. It's weird that novelty was just in there on part of the label. So I don't know. It's almost an unnecessary label. I feel like comedy's comedy. You know, if it's funny to you, then it's probably comedy. Probably. You know,
those early Red Fox albums they're really good. I mean, really good material. It's really funny, and he didn't just recycle the same stuff on every record. They're, you know, you could tell he put a lot of work into his act. Those are really good records. I mean, I've gone back to them for repeated listening, which isn't always the case with comedy albums.
Same. Yeah.
In the time you've done your show, is there like one or is there like a top three that people, you know, have in common that is, are there ones that kind of come up a lot that people tend to like?
Absolutely. And I think they might all be on my wall. I have a record wall of actually should be an even number. Why is it 11? But I have 11 records on the wall. No, wait, I cannot count 14. I'm sorry. So George Carlin's Class Clown, Steve Martin's Let's Get Small. and the Button Down Mind of Bob Newhart, they're all up there. Those three, and we've done Class Clown, I think, 7 times on this show, and maybe the same for Let's Get Small. And the only reason I allow people to come back and talk about it is like, well, your perspective is what matters, because you're probably not going to talk about the same stuff that everybody else does necessarily. So yeah, we've covered some of those records numerous times. I don't allow Class Clown anymore, only because we've covered it 7 times and it's one of my favorites and I don't want to ruin it for myself. So yeah, those are three big ones. I also think that does come from my own personal bias, unintentional. I need more black artists on the show and more, female artists on the show, because there'd be so much more stuff that we'd be talking about that I have also no right to just talk about on the show on my own, which is why, you know, I love, when, you know, we talked about Red Fox a couple weeks ago. Is it already out? Yeah, it's already out. Talked about Red Fox, and that was so much fun, because I don't talk about Red Fox that often, because I didn't grow up with him. I'm usually, if I was going to pick it, it'd be something I grew up with, usually. I wish I'd heard Rudy Ray Moore as a kid. I think I would have appreciated it. I probably would have been up my alley at 13. I'm like, Mom, listen to the swearing this guy's doing. You know, so much of that.
He's got a lot of great albums. I mean, I'm the big fan of Rudy's comedy records.
I also, do you own any of his music? Because I mean, that was the part I think that threw me, because I don't think I knew that he was a musician before this.
I did. I have. There's a record label called Norton Records, a really great label up in New York, and they've, you know, reissued his rhythm and blues stuff over the years. I had those, and I even have a Christmas album he did, vocal record. Yeah.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
So I was pretty familiar with his musical output.
Yeah, of course. That's so good. Are there other influences in here that I might not, I'm ignorant, but are there other influences on this that we haven't discussed other than, you know, the movies and your particular love of also bringing in three musicians who knew what the hell they were doing? Who had played it before, I mean?
Yeah. Well, there was, a lot of really great musicians and engineers and arrangers who came in and worked on this. I have a band called the Bow Keys, and when I'm not doing film work or producing records, you know, we tour and we make our own records, and we work with this really great soul singer named Don Bryant. So some of the guys in the Bow Keys are also involved in the soundtrack. Mark Franklin, who's the trumpet player, he was the arranger for the score, and also the other ones that I've done for Craig, and he's a really talented guy. And someone else that performed on the score that was really special to get to work with was the trombonist Fred Wesley. Mm-hmm. And he was a member of the James Browns, the JBs. And Fred collaborated with James Brown on the scores that James Brown did in the 70s. And we, it was kind of a dream of mine to work with Fred Wesley. And I kept hearing, you know, earlier when I said sometimes, you know, I'll associate characters in a film with their own instruments. Well, I kept hearing like a trombone, and I kept hearing Fred Wesley. I kept hearing the voice of his trombone in the score, and called him up, and he was game for coming to Memphis and playing on it. So it was really special to have him be part of it.
That's amazing. I love having having that kind of an ear for a character and associating it with an instrument, knowing who the hell you want, and obviously then having the privilege to like, hey, you want to come over and do this? Like, I can't imagine inviting a hero of mine to play along. I mean, on a big project like that, and then just, oh yeah, sure, I'll show up. That's phenomenal. I mean, that's so good. And these are the things now that I obviously have to listen for. So now I'm going to have to give it a few more listens, and I'm assuming you have a few copies of this. Do you have the purple one? Because I won't say I'm disappointed. Mondo was very kind to send me the record, but I didn't know the purple one existed until today. And it's beautiful.
The purple ones are pretty hard to come by.
Are they?
not a lot of those floating around up there. I do have one, but it was even difficult for me to get.
That's so funny. That is funny.
It's so dark. You could barely tell. It's such a dark purple that it almost looks like the regular version of it.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I mentioned this earlier on Instagram today, but this is going on the wall, not only because of how much I love it, but the cover is fantastic. And well, obviously, next time you're in LA, when the world is not burning anymore, I would love to have you sign it. I'd love to have you here to sign it because, holy crap, so good.
I'd be happy to do it.
So good. Well, this is going to, and I apologize in advance, it's going to come out in quite some time. I've been banking these early just in case. So it won't come out for probably a couple of months, but I would love for you to tell people where they can find you online, and if you have any projects coming up that we should keep our eyes out for.
Sure. I have a website, and it's www.scottbomar.com.
Mm-hmm.
You go there, you know, there's all kinds of information on there about what I do and projects I've worked on, and I have a recording studio in Memphis called Electrophonic Recording, and you can check that out. That's where we recorded most of the score for this. We did all the rhythm section tracks there, and then we did the overdubs at Royal Studios in Memphis. And also have a web store there, and I'm selling copies of the Dolomite Is My Name vinyl, and they're signed copies. And
oh, awesome.
You can order them there. And I have other things for sale there as well. I have a new album I produced by the soul artist Don Bryant, and the album is called You Make Me Feel. It's on Fat Possum Records. It came out on June 19th, and it's been featured on NPR, and KCRW out there in LA's played it, and it's going over real well. So definitely look for Don Bryant's album, You Make Me Feel.
Awesome. Holy cow. That's some good stuff. Everybody else has been like, they're mostly comedians, because they're like, nope, I don't have anything coming up. No, you've got records in the works. You've got stuff out there. That's remarkable. Scott, this has been fantastic. I really appreciate you talking with me. I'm going to recommend everybody, please go see the damn movie and buy the soundtrack. The soundtrack is so good. I rarely pick up soundtracks, well, full disclosure, this was sent to me, but I would have bought it, if they hadn't. It's so, so good. I don't know. I just really appreciate you doing the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate you inviting me to come on and do it. It's been fun.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs, and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15 plus years. Stolen Dress Entertainment.
Hey, it's my turn.